Good morning and welcome to the Monday, April 12th edition of the National Research Subcommittee. We are today in the process of continuing our hearing on House Bill 5019, the budget and agency program for the Department of Environmental Quality. We're continuing with our agency program presentations, and when we left off on Thursday, it was with Mary Wall, the Division Administrator of Waste Management and Cleanup Division, and I gather we're going to pick up there and move forward.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jenner, Brandon Marsh, DEQ Director, and with Mary Wall, as you mentioned, and we're going to do exactly what you said, Mr. Chair, except where we left off.
And colleagues, today we have the House in session at 10, so we will adjourn.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Mary Wall, Administrator of Waste Management and Cleanup. Just to back up to a couple of the questions that were asked last week, first on Umatilla, I'll bring treated material tomorrow, a small packet for each member, and then we'll try to put together a quick presentation on some of the safety issues that you asked, but we'll do that later on and not during my presentation. There was a question about New Way Oil and whether there had been fines levied against them. That was one of the cleanups that I talked about that's an orphan site, and in fact, we have not. I believe that EPA levied a $1,500 fine, but we haven't, in large part because they looked like they were becoming an orphan site and in fact did, so there was no point in doing a fine. There was another question asked about used oil and what were the options that people had. It's part of the curbside collection process, so anybody that wants to can put it at curbside if you're in a town that's 4,000 or more. Surprisingly, actually, very few people do, or not very many. Maybe 25% of it gets collected that way. Most of what does get collected that way gets burned. There was another question about commercial tanks and can they be left in place, just decommissioned in place, and the answer that I didn't have then but I can tell you now is that yes, they can be left in place and filled with sand like the heating oil tanks in people's backyards. People don't typically do that for a couple of reasons. One is that it's tough to get below them to sample, and people, you know, unless they're structural impediments, people typically take them out. Also because at a station, they're generally going to replace them, so they take them out. So that was the answer on that one. I think that's all the questions that I had not answered before.
Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've got an insert of hazardous substances.
Exactly.
I don't see TBT on there. Is that not a regulated substance, or is it listed on the list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nestle, are you looking at the pulled-out chart at the very back of the packet? What this is the substances, it's just some of the substances that are most often found at cleanup sites. It is a hazardous substance. It's a very hazardous substance in some cases. And it's not on here just because we didn't get all of them on there, not because it isn't regulated or isn't a hazardous substance.
Well, Mr. Is that relatively new then? Because my understanding is a couple of years ago, it was not a federally listed or something.
Representative Nestle, I have to check if it is not listed federally. It is on ours as a hazardous substance. I could check for you and get back to you tomorrow on that one.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving forward then, I was nearly finished with talking to you about the impacts and the threats to Oregon's environment, and then I was planning to move into the section to talk about what DEQ does to address those threats. And also in that part, I'll talk about the size of the environmental problems that we have and the progress that we're making across the state to fix those problems. I'm on slide number 14 for those of you following in your packet, and I believe it's on page 7. Bottom of page 7 for you. What I'd like to do is just talk for a minute about solid waste and the fact that in this state, solid waste, the amount that we actually generate every year is continuing to increase. We continue to increase also the amount that we recycle or recover. So the amount that we're generating in this state right now is about the equivalent of 7 pounds per person per day of solid waste generated. and the amount that we recycle or recover, you can see at the top of the chart, the blue part of the chart shows how much we recover. So we aren't disposing of a lot more every year, but we're generating more and barely keeping up with that, and in some cases falling slightly behind in how much we recycle. What it speaks to is the need to really work on the end of not generating solid waste in the first place. Moving on then, I'd like to finish this section by just mentioning again the why of all of this work, why these impacts matter and what's impacted. All of these examples of threats to Oregon's environment point to the primary reason, and that is threats to water. Most Oregonians rely on groundwater to drink, nearly half of them, and just over 75% drink either groundwater or surface water, of course. But it's groundwater primarily that the waste programs are aimed at assisting and protecting. The beaker on the right just shows, again, some of the common contaminants that you find in groundwater. And again, there is a chart at the very back of your packet that talks about some of the contaminants that we find, the kinds of uses that there are, the way they get to people or the environment, and some of the human health effects of those contaminants.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we have a discussion? I think I mentioned it when Mr. Marsh was in his overview at the beginning about the types of ground and soils and water tables and those different impacts of when the water is contaminated, because it's not 100% true. It doesn't always go down and contaminate groundwater, does it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, you're right. It doesn't always go down and contaminate groundwater, and the kind of soil that's there makes a big difference. And in one of the ways that we, there are several ways that difference gets built into what people have to do with their sites in across the waste programs. And solid waste, for instance, in the eastern part of the state, they have to meet a different requirement, because in a lot of cases it's so far to groundwater, so it doesn't make sense to have all of the monitoring in place, especially at some of the what they call small remote landfills. The same is the case at cleanup, either at tank sites or at the regular cleanup sites, that what kind of soil you have and what kind of, for instance, layer you have that will stop the movement of contamination can make a big difference, huge difference in the kind of cleanup you have to do. So the kinds of soils make a huge difference, and the rock, and whether there are slips in the rock and that sort of thing to let it go on down to the aquifers. Are you asking, though, for a more detailed explanation of that, or?
Well, I'm not sure if I can follow up. My concern is that even within a very small area, you can go from sandstone soils, that's to peat soils, to, and I'm just thinking what I'm familiar with in my business background. And are we allowing for those kind of adjustments as we make our regulations and requirements for tanks or cleanup or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, actually in both the tank cleanup program and in the regular cleanup program, what we have been able to come to is several different routes, if you will, to clean up. And at a site, you can imagine, if you have site-specific differences, it's down to that level. If you have site-specific differences that suggest that, for instance, it's not going to travel through the groundwater, you can present that information, and then it's a different cleanup, even at the very down to the level of this site compared to this site. So you can do that and have a site-specific cleanup and take into account all the information that's available on your site. There's also, because that might not be the route that a business would want to go, because it takes a little more time and a little upfront, really investigation to figure out that your site really is protective, even if you don't do a higher level of cleanup. If you don't want to go that route, there are more, if you will, cookbook routes. So you can just say, for soils, here are the numbers, you meet those, you're finished. So those are more conservative, but if you want to, for instance, just dig and haul, so you don't have to go through the study that this one would get you, it's a balance, and it's generally a business decision. You can do more study, less cleanup, or don't do the study and just dig and haul, and sometimes that's cheaper and just as effective. So Yeah, and, I mean, down to the site level, you can have different cleanups based on different conditions.
Just sure to follow up one more time. Aren't we getting this down to a pretty good science in most cases? And what I'm concerned about is the tremendous cost that's involved with doing the studies. And aren't we getting enough experience to where we can determine, I like a cookbook, most of it now? Because I know this is a huge problem, not only in the waste cleanup, but in building our highways and this kind of thing. We require so much time and money spent on some of the study, and that's and I think that there's a point where we have enough experience that we can make some judgments without all that expense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nestor, last session in Senator Parno's committee, we talked about this very thing, especially with tanks, because tank cleanups, yeah, and that's one where we have a lot of examples of the same kind of cleanup and the same kind of contaminant. So what we came out of that committee meeting with, or that discussion, was instead of a statute change, low impact cleanups, and it's like a generic cleanup, if you will. So what the industry was after in that case, and legitimately so, was a carve off of all the low impact sites. If you're fairly certain that it's not going to hit water, and you can monitor, that's when you can, what we came to was take out the source, you know, the source of the contamination, so it's not leaking ongoing, and then monitor, and as long as it's not hitting water and it's not hitting somebody else's property, you can basically stop there. And that's because over the last 10 years we have learned something. The industry has, we have, and jointly that's what we came up with. And we're just now letting those rules play out to make sure they really carve off enough of the sites to make it worthwhile for industry. But that's exactly the kind of thing that we're coming up with.
In those cases where you remove the source, what happens 20 years later if you retest? Is that decimated to some degree of the contaminant, or is it, does it, does it encapsulate itself and still stay contaminant years and years in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Messler, the fact is it depends. In the case of petroleum, a lot of times it dissipates. What you need to worry about primarily, of course, or maybe more than just the volume of petroleum, is the things like benzene. But if you can get the source, so you don't have more benzene, some of that actually can happen with what they call natural attenuation, just letting it degrade over time if you get the worst part out. It's not always the case, and there are some cases where you don't get a clean clothes letter, if you will, if you do that, but if, as long as you don't change uses, you're probably okay. If you want to upgrade that property and then use it for residential or something, then you have to look again and see if additional cleanup is needed, but often by that time it isn't needed, is what we're finding. And what that allows us to do is then really spend our time on some of the high priority ones. So,
we hear a lot about the hydraulic connection between groundwater and surface water. And you have a list of pollutants in the groundwater on the chart. Do you know if there is a direct connection, or at least a connection between surface water pollutants or toxic substances and those going into an aquifer or groundwater? Is there a connection? Do you folks have the ability to draw that distinction or connect those two together with those trace elements that go into an aquifer or groundwater source?
Mr. Chair, we have a great deal of expertise in just that. A lot of people at DEQ are hydrogeologists, for instance, and toxicologists, and we do know a lot. There's also there's a lot we don't know about that, but that's something that's part of the reason that we can do things like Representative Messerly was asking about, is that we do know a lot more now about those kinds of connections. It's not perfect science yet, but there are connections back and forth between surface water and groundwater, and one recharges the other depending upon time of year and that sort of thing. And different contaminants move at different rates. They attach to different soils at different rates, but a lot of that is known. And all of that information can get piled into and built into the actual cleanup level. Because if it's not going to move, that's a piece of information. And that now can get built in. When you want to build more of that information in so that you can do less cleanup based on it, that's what I was talking about earlier, where it takes a bit more you know, everybody hates study, but you can put a bit more money into the upfront investigation and a lot of times end up with less cleanup that's still protected so long as you have found out what all those connections are. Moving on then to the next slide, I will be talking now about DEQ's role in addressing these threats. And I'd like to start at the bottom of this one, actually, to talk about what DEQ does to address these problems. Starting at the bottom is cleanup. This often happens as a result of past actions that we're still dealing with, and basically it's when waste is released or leaked and threatens the environment and humans, then it needs to be cleaned up to prevent future or expanded damage. The reason cleanup is at the bottom is that there is a hierarchy and it's much cheaper and more effective to start at the top, but I'm starting at the bottom to just work through what DEQ does. The second one is safe management. That's essentially safely manage or dispose of waste that can't be prevented or that's already occurred. Prevention, of course, is to prevent the generation of waste or spills in the first place. That's what I was talking about with the solid waste part. This one is increasingly where the focus is because it is cheaper and more effective, and it makes sense. It just makes sense to do that if you can. Moving then to the one on the bottom, cleanup. when it's gotten through the prevention and the safe management screen, and we are cleaning up.
I have a question from Mr. McKean.
I see that we're dealing with them as waste, but you deal with them maybe for their waste. While they're still, received or in the product stream.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, in the waste program, typically by definition it needs to be waste before we deal with it, but a lot of the, especially in hazardous waste, dealing with companies that handle hazardous substances as part of their business or in the way they treat the process, we can deal with that so that it's before it actually goes out the end of the pipe or whatever as waste. People look, especially with technical assistance, you can do some good there. And that's where we really can keep it from becoming hazardous waste. And I will show you some examples later of the fairly simple, straightforward things that we can do on that end. So, yeah, there is some activity at that end of the hierarchy.
Thank you.
Moving then into some of the cleanups. For cleanups, you can think of it doing basically two fundamental things. First, of course, is to protect human health and the environment, and the second is to promote reuse of land. And I'll talk about the reuse in a few minutes, but I'd like to talk first for a couple minutes about the cleanup. DEQ's role is to oversee the cleanup, and essentially to try to find the lowest cost ways to provide the necessary protection. There are several routes to cleanups. We talked about a few of these just in answer to the questions. The route that you pick depends on things like how severe the contamination is, the willingness and the ability of the party to participate and do the cleanup, and importantly, the interest of the party, because the responsible party or the owner may want to do something very different, and we can often work with that. There are four different kinds of cleanups that I'd like to mention. The worst sites, the highest priority, or the most serious ones, DEQ ensures that the work gets done through an order. On the second kind, they're orphans, and those are those same most serious ones or the worst ones, but in those cases the owner or the other party isn't known, or they're unwilling, or they're unable to do the cleanup, in which case the state does the cleanup. The third kind are voluntary cleanups. In those, the responsible party actually steps up and agrees to do the cleanup. Two-thirds of the cleanups in this state are voluntary right now. There are 300 going on in the state, and two-thirds of those, 200 of them, are voluntary. They're done either under an order or under a letter agreement, which might not sound like any big deal to just move from an order to a letter agreement, but when you're a business and you're working with lenders and your stock reports and that sort of thing, it does make a big deal, a big difference, to be able to have a letter agreement and to be recognized for what you're willing to step up and do. Also, on the voluntary ones, they can terminate. They can walk away from them. And the only exception to that is if they come in and it looks like a medium or a low environmental priority, and it turns out to be a very high priority. We've had a couple of those where they have come in as a voluntary, and we've said that we can't terminate. But the rest of them can terminate and walk away and do work independently or stop doing it in a lot of cases. What's important about the voluntary cleanup is they're the same cleanup as any other cleanup in the state. That's a fundamental underlying thing with all the cleanups in the state. They all have to meet the same levels of cleanup. And the fourth kind, or the other kind that I'd like to mention, that's sort of a subset of the voluntary cleanups, are independent. Independent cleanups happen in this state. Probably of the ones that come to DEQ, that 20% of them are independent. Part of the reason for that is that in this state, if you have a release that you discover of hazardous substances, you don't have to report it to the agency. That's different than spills and it's different than tank releases, but you don't have to report hazardous substance past releases. And just so you know what these pictures are, Chambers Oil in North Bend, we were doing demolition of tanks and other structures there. There was significant contamination in the soil. It's near the bay, and we were hoping that it didn't get into the bay. What you're looking at on the right is one of the workers who used to have on an entirely green suit was in the tank working on making sure that it was ready for demolition and also doing some testing. This is the second picture of Chambers Oil. It started out actually as an orphan site, and this is the point is that, well, it was a couple months ago or a few months ago, nearing completion of the work there. There are several tracks or options that DEQ can use for these different sites. You've probably heard about brownfields. Brownfields are essentially sites where there is infrastructure, so there could be development, but people, because of the contamination, tend to shy away from those until they're cleaned up, and they go to what's known as a greenfield or a completely open site. Those are typically good candidates for the options that the state has to promote reuse. One of those options that we use a lot is a prospective purchaser agreement. And what that is a tool that basically allows the state to trade. So somebody comes in and buys a piece of property, and they would typically have liability then for whatever happens on that site afterwards. The prospective purchaser agreement trades so that the state limits their liability, it pushes to the state, and they bring either cleanup work, contribution, or some other public benefit. Chambers Oil, what happened there is the city actually was agreeing to do some of the work or pay for some of the work that the state had already done. So they agreed to help monitor the groundwater. They helped tap the site. They abandoned some of the groundwater monitoring wells, and they made a limited financial contribution to help the state so that it could use the state's money to do the next orphan site. So that's how the prospective purchaser agreements happen. I'd like to run through then just three quick examples of how these options work to get reuse at the sites that we're doing cleanup. What you're looking at in the photos, the upper left is Peterson's Furniture Store that did have a prospective purchaser agreement. That's in Ontario. Lower left is Belmont Dairy, also had a prospective purchaser agreement. This is in Portland. And on the right are before and after pictures of the development in Bend, the old mill district. This wasn't a prospective purchaser agreement, but we did work real closely with this owner. The reason it can't be a prospective purchaser agreement is that the person that's owning it already has it and already has the liability, so it's not somebody coming in to buy the property and take some of the state's liability. On Peterson's, the problem was that it was an old furniture store site. There were soil and groundwater contamination, and it had been vacant for more than 10 years. The benefit that they brought, the public benefit, was it's an important redevelopment part for Ontario. It's going to provide 50 to 80 jobs, part of the downtown revitalization project, and the purchaser paid some contribution. It was very limited. It was less than $5,000, but at least they contributed to the state's cost. And in exchange, they got their liability limited and also got work from DEQ along the way to tell them how much was already cleaned up and that sort of thing so they could get loans. Belmont Dairy, real quickly, is the problem was heavy contamination from petroleum in soils from lots of underground storage tanks. There were also buildings contaminated with asbestos, PCBs, and lead. This is the benefit they brought is this is an entire block project. They brought in $11.5 million in construction costs. This is public and private. They also have 85 housing units above all of the retail stuff on the ground floor, and 66 of those are low-income housing. The PPA was key to this one. It wouldn't have happened without the prospective purchaser agreement. And the last one is Old Mill District in Bend. Again, this wasn't a PPA, it wasn't a prospective purchaser agreement. You will, in your packet of letters that we'll show to you tomorrow, have a letter from the developer in this case, because it was somebody who was not excited about working with the EQ when we started, was not excited about doing the cleanup, but we found ways to work with them and actually help this project. A couple of the things we could do is focus the investigation, figure out where it was most likely to be, and focus the investigation just on those parts of the ground, and proceed in a way that really fit with his business needs. So those are some of the things that we can do to make these cleanups really move to reuse. Just to give you an idea of the cleanup sites that exist in the state, and at the back of your packet, any of these maps, they're a little hard to see in the black and white, but at the back of your packet there's also a color version that's a full sheet of these. So on the cleanup sites in Oregon, there are 469 that are cleaned up or off the books. There are 1,622 that are left to be dealt with. A lot of those will be done independently. DEQ starts with the highest priority and we work our way down through them. And a lot of these are cleaned up independently and DEQ doesn't get involved or just gets involved after the fact. So though it sounds like 1,622 is a lot, and it is, there is a great deal of progress and we're working on the highest priority ones first. I mentioned that there are 300 cleanups going on across the state. A dozen of those are federal Superfund sites. So the state has, in the cleanup program, the vast majority of them at the state level, not at the federal level. just to talk about comparisons of numbers, before...
Just while before you get into that comparison, Justin Johnson has a question about that.
Well, maybe it's in the comparison of numbers. There's a couple of questions. If I look at the numbers that you have there since 1988, I believe, if I'm reading that correctly, 469 completed, then we go down below and it said add 13 months. My arithmetic says that this is a losing proposition, that we're adding more than we're cleaning up. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denton, your math is correct, and the thing that works in our favor on the other side is that we are working on the highest priority ones first, that a lot of the ones that are listed as to be cleaned are ones that will be done independently, or some of those will be low priorities and we won't end up needing to clean them up at all. The other thing that's working in our favor is that before 1994, we were just as we started this program, the pace was slow, and so we were completing 25 a year. We're now at an average of 65 a year since 94, and last year there were 73 finished. So the pace is picking up, in addition to the ones that are done independently. When we started with this program, we were predicting 3 or 4 decades to take care of the cleanup problem in Oregon. As we look at it now, we probably have a decade and a half left of cleanup. It's not as bad as it looked when we started. There's a lot to do. I mean, this is a big tale of cleanups that we had in the state to deal with. The other thing, just so you have, and this was the comparison I was going to mention, our number is 469 completed. And just to be clear about that, we include everything there. Even if we go to a site and it turns out that very little has to be done, or it's just the first level of assessment that we need to do and then we stop, we count that. At the federal level across the entire country in the Superfund program, the number is 585, and those are probably actual cleanups. So I don't want to mislead you. I mean, even if you discount our number for some of those are small cleanups and some of those are ones that we don't do much, compared to the federal, we are making a lot of headway in Oregon and we're at an accelerating pace.
Follow up for Fantastic.
It helped me a little with my thinking on this, but the federal Superfund sites, 12 of those in the state, 2 have been cleaned up to date, so there are 10 left, is that right? And that's all federal hours?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, it's either federal dollars if it's an orphan, if the responsible party can't pay, or it's the responsible party paying. So under the federal program, just like under the state program, if there's somebody there who is viable and can pay for it, they pay for it. It's the whole polluter pays concept. But if it's an orphan, either under the federal or the state, the state or federal program would pay.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
The sighting in Umatilla, I assume, is the default. And are we referring, with your sighting there, to the Murphy's, or are we referring to the explosion of ammunition that took place over a long period of time?
Mr. Chair.
Are they working on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denson, in that case, it's not the depot. It's actually from the ordinance, the used ordinance, the unexploded ordinance, or from work that they have done there. And there was a fairly significant cleanup that was needed there. It's underway. It's been underway for quite a while. And in that case, the Army pays for our work and EPA's work. Moving down. I mentioned that two-thirds of Oregon's cleanups are voluntary. I think there's been some concern that people are reluctant to sign up for voluntary cleanups. And in fact, what's happened over the last, since 96, is the number, from the start of this program in 1991, the number coming in per month has just clicked along steadily, three new voluntary cleanups every month. That number has doubled since 96. So people are coming into the voluntary cleanup program. I think there are a couple reasons that there are more coming in now than before. One of them is, in 95, we rewrote this law, the Oregon cleanup law, to make it risk-based, which is some of the stuff that we were talking about when Representative Messery was asking the questions about how we decide how much cleanup to do. The other thing is, frankly, that there has been an economic boom, so more people are stepping up to clean up their sites so that they can sell them or develop them. We also, since 95, have worked actively with businesses to make these cleanups more market-driven. There are things you can do. One of them I mentioned was the letter agreement. It makes a big difference. Figuring out a way to let people terminate these agreements if they volunteer and want out so that they don't feel like they have to sign up forever and not have a way out. Those kinds of things make a huge difference. And they're able to get out, and it's increased, I think, the numbers coming into this program. The other thing that does keep people coming into the voluntary cleanup program is lenders want state sign-off on a cleanup before they're going to lend on it, and purchasers often want them. So people come into the voluntary cleanup program as opposed to coming into the enforcement program. If they need to do the cleanup, they'd rather do it as a voluntary than an enforcement cleanup. So if I could talk then just for a few minutes about some of the specifics that we've done to make these voluntary cleanups more market-driven. The first one, if you're going to meet business needs, is that the agency actually has to understand the business needs. And we've worked a lot with different businesses to figure out what it is that will make a difference so that they can move forward. Cleanup is obviously the first priority with these sites, but we also do whatever we can to meet business demands. A few of the examples are, the first one, and this was a while ago, we exempted lenders in this state from liability in most instances, and that is basically aimed at encouraging lending so that people can get loans on these properties, and that's part of the way they can clean them up. The simplified process, making it a cookbook in some cases, if you will, it may cost a bit more, it's a bit more conservative cleanup, but it gives them speed and it gives them certainty. And a lot of people say that speed's worth more to them than time is money, and they'd rather have the seed even if they have to clean up a bit more. This next one, the Focus Advisory Group, I hate the name of this group, but it is actually one that's been very effective, and that's what we called it, so we ended up with the name. This is the one where we worked with business representatives and came up with things like the OK to Terminate agreement. Another one that we came up with in this discussion is time budgets. They wanted time budgets from the outset of a cleanup so that they'd know that these things were eventually going to be over and how long we were going to spend on each of the parts. The other thing that we have done with this group is an independent cleanup pathway. And again, an independent cleanup doesn't mean that they don't meet state requirements. It's the same cleanup in any case. They can come in afterwards and get an approval from the state. It's the same level of protection, and a lot of cleanups are done under this one.
I'm sorry,
if you want to finish this, I want to go back to the first point when you get in.
I'm finished.
Okay. Mr. Chair? Thank you. Could you expand on the lender's liability, what that really means? If the lender doesn't have the liability, then who does? I guess that's what I'm getting at. And where does that end up as it goes down the chain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, if a bank loans on a piece of property, there was some question early on in the entire cleanup program, not just in Oregon, but across the country, that if they loaned on the piece of property and then they were in the chain of title just for, chain of custody just for that purpose, that they could be held liable for anything that happened at that property and have to clean it up. So what we did was say that a bank or any other kind of lending institution would only be liable if they stepped over the line and actually ended up managing it. So if there's a loan on your property, nothing changes on the liability. The owner is still liable or anybody else that contributed to the contamination, but not the bank. So a bank doesn't get pulled in. The fact is that banks were saying they weren't going to do loans if they were held liable. So that's what happened with it.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Someone borrows money to buy a piece of industrial property. And at some point in the future, it's found that it has contaminants, and the owner of that property leaves the property. The bank is exempt from having any liability at that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, they are unless they acted as a manager of that. You know, if they stepped over the line into management of the property, like, there were some banks that were doing things like directing the owners on what they could do and what they couldn't do and what they could buy and couldn't buy or use and not use on those properties. In some cases, that got into the gray area. But otherwise, yes, they're exempt.
Chair, I don't want to drive Mr. Graham, but I think it's an important distinction. If they take over management of that property because the owner they took the property back, then they sell it. Where does that leave them as they try to find the market for that property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, if they take over because there's a bankruptcy, there's still protection for them, and what would be liable then is just the estate, for instance, not the bank's assets itself. So there's still a distinction, and they can still do all the things they need to do as a bank, including taking over the property in bankruptcy without triggering their liability. And again, the bank was saying we could never take over a piece of property, so we are not going to get into those kinds of loans if we're not protected. So bankruptcy is carved out as well. If they just do the things that you would need to do in bankruptcy, and actually in the bankruptcy part of it, there's a bit more flexibility even than in just the loan.
Thank you.
Senator Turner, did you have a question?
Yes. Sir, Barry, are you aware of the dialogue going on between Weyerhaeuser and Nucor Steel and Tuesday, November?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carno, at least superficially, I don't know all of the dialogue, no, but I know that you're talking, yes.
The issues I understand, and maybe you know more about it than I do by far, but is the soil is allegedly contaminated, that's currently owned by Waco. And the discussion is that Nucor Steel is concerned about future contaminants, that they're responsible for any future contaminants. Would that fall in a prospective purchase agreement? If Nucor Steel is purchasing that property from Weyerhaeuser, would that be part of that agreement package that they come to? And how do you folks get into the fray of this discussion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carno, first, that one is at least a possibility for a prospective purchaser agreement. I haven't looked at all the information about that site. But if there were a cleanup going on there and the state was going to end up liable for any part of it, yes, there could be a prospective purchaser agreement where the new one coming in could say, for instance, it just happened with a Home Depot site in another part of the state, where the deep pocket, if you will, Home Depot said, I'll take the soil, but I won't take the groundwater problem. You have to make the existing owner stay liable for that. So the state could work on one like that. To my knowledge, there isn't a question about whether the two of them will be able to work out their differences. And so it would be, you know, I'd really need to look at what the issues were and whether the state was going to end up liable for any of it or whether a prospective purchaser agreement would be key to that whole agreement. But we could certainly look at it and see what the circumstances are. I'm just not familiar with the details of it.
Mr. Chair, question?
If I could follow up a little bit on the senator's question. Thank you. As I understand the situation, now they've got a case where the lagoons that are permitted adjacent to the property they're going to purchase is what they're afraid of, that at some point those lagoons will seep into the property that they're going to develop. In that case, did you have a prospective purchaser agreement with Nucor that should that permitted potential stores moved onto their property that they would be shipped?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, in a situation like that, what the state would do typically is look for an agreement. If you were going to say that the purchaser had no liability, you would look to the original owner to keep the liability if possible, rather than have it end up as a state liability to do any cleanup like that. If they were, again, I need to look at the circumstances, and we need to make sure that it fits within the prospective purchaser agreement requirements, but at least those are the kinds of properties that we could be looking at. But it is, more typically, there are sites that are maybe going to become orphans, but nothing's going to happen at those sites, and it's going to end up a state liability or a state problem to clean up, or they've sat there for a long time, and we need to do something to move them. But we could at least look at that one.
Yeah. Paula?
Evidently, they haven't called you in or your department in to look at that yet. Could you offer yourself for that? Maybe you can break this deadlock with those people. And I really am hesitant to say that because I don't like to see government get involved if they don't need to, particularly in the private negotiations. But if there's something that we could offer as a state, it might help break that deadlock.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I do believe that, well, I'm not sure that the assistance has been offered. I mean, I'm quite certain that the representatives of the two companies know what the state's authorities are, but we would be glad to offer any assistance we could toward resolving that issue. And you're right, we have not been requested to do that yet.
Anything further?
There is native groundwater and surface water protection also gained by upgrading and cleaning up old petroleum tanks. We talked about some of the changes in the technology and the rules on these. The end result across the state on these is that there are clean stations and protected groundwater. There's also, importantly, productive property. What you're looking at here on the left is drill rig for sampling after the air stripping occurred. And on the right is an old bed for the underground storage tanks that were removed. There's contamination in the front part of this picture. And actually, at this one, the work is over and new tanks went in. Just to give you an idea of the size of the problem across the state, this map shows you, and once again, there is a full map in the back of the packet. It shows you the releases or the leaks from regulated tanks, not heating oil tanks, regulated tanks. And this shows that the sites with what we call NFA, which is no further action, those that are cleaned, and then the ones still left to be cleaned, about half of the ones where we know there are leaks in the state have been cleaned up. The upgrade deadline, as you know, was last December. As of the 1st of January of this year, there were just over 6,000 contaminated sites. 48% of those have been completed. Again, there probably are a lot more that are clean and are just not into the DEQ data yet. We do expect that starting with the year 2000, the number of releases is going to drop off. In this year, 1999, we'll be finding a lot of them because people had a year to decommission their tanks after the deadline. So we think that the number of leaks reported will drop, and probably in this one, rather than a decade and a half, at the current level of staffing, we're a decade of cleanup. We'll have a decade. Oregon does require that tanks do the cleanup. It's also assisting the owners to upgrade and clean up these tanks. The legislature actually deserves a lot of credit in this one for significant financial help. Over the last few years, there's been about $8 million in help to tank owners.
It's kind of a burning question, Mr. Chiamiri. The blue sheet, hazardous substance cleanup site, and then the green sheet, regulated petroleum tank cleanup. Looking at the I-5 corridor is a major problem for us. And because you've got numbers of Clackamas, you've got all those Superfund sites up in Clackamas and Multnomah County. And I'm just kind of curious, am I wrong, or is the area along the I-5 corridor the majority of where these numbers are coming from?
Mr. Chair, Senator DeSarno, you're not wrong. Cleanup and tank cleanup both tend to follow industry and population, so the numbers are greater there. But this isn't just an urban problem by any stretch. They really are, you know, to the extent there's industry and population in other parts of the state, there are significant numbers in other parts of the state. Even sparsely populated counties in the eastern part of the state have significant numbers. They're certainly not like in the Willamette Valley, but it follows industry. So just to talk about a couple of the sites where, and to give you an example of the kind of financial assistance that's been provided to the rural tanks. Burns Junction is the one on the left. This was the only gas station on a 150-mile stretch from Burns to the Nevada border. There we replaced old underground storage tanks with new above-ground systems. The Post General Store on the right was the only retail station on a 58-mile stretch of highway. It's important to note that there were emergency services in the area, like the county sheriff, medical vehicles, and even things like the U.S. Forest Service and BLM that use this facility routinely, which was a key reason for giving it a financial assistance grant from the state. UPS also has to get fuel here to complete its full route, so this one was a key one to keep in business, if you will. Moving then to the heating oil tanks, these are not the regulated stations, but the heating oil tanks. This one in the photo, there's a line leak from the heating oil tank that impacted the homeowner's crawl space. Oil from this leak got into a drain and into a creek, which means the impacts from these typically are localized to the home area, but they're not always minor and they don't always stay on people's property. The real estate market, I think I mentioned earlier, really influences how fast we find these and which ones we find, because typically they're found when people sell their homes. Lending institutions and also purchasers want DEQ to review and approve these before they purchase. Right now, DEQ is getting between 11 and 12,000 calls a year from homeowners, so there's clearly a demand for technical assistance and oversight on these from homeowners, and we do have a package on this one. We can't meet the demand for technical assistance at this point. We can't keep up with the calls or the oversight, and what we've had to do is pull people off other tank work, and we just can't keep up with it anymore. So you will see a package on it. You also may hear about, and you may see, we're looking for a comprehensive fix, if you will, on the heating oil tanks this session. What the EQ is asking for, and I think I mentioned this last time, is a pump-out requirement. So at least if there's fuel left in those tanks, it would just be pumped out if you change to a different heating source. And also for some way to make the funding from last session that was put in place last session work, because the funding didn't happen. Neither the grants to homeowners to work on these tanks nor the staffing for the EQ happened from last time.
Why didn't it work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, it was basically an assessment on heating oil fuel sales that was supposed to pay for grants to homeowners. They were small, but there were a lot of them. And then it was also paid for 5 DEQ staff to do all the technical assistance and the oversight, and the assessment wasn't put in place, so there was no funding. We got a little bit of federal funding from a grant to pay for a few grants to homeowners, but the funding that was put in place didn't happen because of that. The assessment didn't occur.
Oh, and that's because the legislature didn't take action, or who didn't follow through? Yes, that's my.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, it was. The Oil Heat Commission is required to put the assessment on heating oil fuel and decided against that, so it didn't happen.
First, I'm not sure there's more to the story.
I'm not going there.
There's more to the story than that. But in a nutshell, the Oil Heat Commission had a different opinion than the action was taken in the legislative session. And could not renew the assessment. Part of their issue was that voluntary assessment to them looked like it was being used to convert oil heat customers to other specialties. team. So that was part of the friction. But I'm sure if you ask the representatives of the oil heat industry, they'll hear a completely different set of motivators for the reason that that assessment didn't move forward. In any case, the program came to the department in name primarily, without very many resources to move it forward. Is that pretty good?
Well, of course. Yes, for sure.
I think I need to say I'm sorry.
Can we move on, Mr. Chair?
What happens to the oil that gets pumped out of these tanks? Does it get burnt also?
Mr. Chair, representing Morgan people, if it's, especially if it's fresh, you can just use it in another heating oil tank. I mean, it's good oil. So you can just take it out and it's good product and it can be used again. So you win both ways. It doesn't leak into the groundwater or the soil, and you can use it again. In fact, a lot of places, people will can be paid for it. You can get a buck a gallon or something, too, if you have somebody pump it out and go use it someplace else. So that's what gets used for. We talked quite a bit already about spills, so I'll go over this one fairly quickly. DEQ's goal is essentially to respond as quickly as possible when there is a spill and clean it up so that there's limited damage. Once it's spilled, of course, the damage is on its way, but to limit the damage to wildlife and the environment, especially water and fish. And what happens as a result, if we can get there quickly, is you can minimize the problem, you can minimize the immediate impact to fish, and wildlife, you can prevent the seepage through the ground into groundwater and avoid long-term, more costly cleanups. Our role is essentially to require the prompt response from whoever is responsible for it, to coordinate the role of all the responders, and this was a question that Representative Morgan asked about what DEQ does if everybody shows up, and it's our job to be the lead agency, the lead state agency, provide oversight to ensure that the environmental response is protective and to be the expert about contamination and what needs to be done. What you're looking at on the left is a cleanup of the slough along the Yaquina River after a train derailment. Immediate action here, at least minimize the impact on the slough, though there was impact to the slough, the wetlands, and to the river in this case, and the people working on this are contractors hired by the railroad itself. On the right is air sparging to remove toluene from groundwater. At this one, toluene is very toxic, and we were trying to make sure that it didn't get to the river, the Umatilla River. This was a train derailment, and there was about 11,000 gallons of toluene that spilled. What we're doing here is forcing air into this ditch that we dug so to capture the water and the contaminant, and transferring it essentially to the air, but it was less damaging to transfer it to the air. Not good, but better than letting it get into the Umatilla River. So some dissolved toluene got in, but not any pure product in this one.
Chair.
Representative Clinton, I have a question.
Not a question, Chair, just a comment that the Umatilla River, which obviously is in my district, and we were... the representative was very impressed with the work that was done and very appreciative of the department's keeping me informed of what was going on at the time that this work was taking place. So I wanted to make that observation for her.
Chair Representative Denson, I think the person that deserves most of the credit in this case is Mike Renz, the Eastern Region bill person. Thank you.
Representative Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the case of the detail that got spilled for the derailment. I'm just trying to get a sense of what that means. First of all, what percentage of the detail that spilled can you recover and clean up? And secondly, in your experience, now maybe just on this example but others, how fast does the body of water and the fisheries or the habitat return to normal state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Metcalfe, how much we get depends on a lot of things. The first one is how fast we can get there. The second one is a little bit like the question you were asking earlier, what does it spill into? If it gets into porous soil that's right next to the river, it can get there real fast and we don't have much chance to get it, you know, capture it before it goes on into the river. An example is there was one of the ones I showed earlier there were 6,000 gallons filled and we captured 600 gallons. Another thing that makes a huge difference is what we were talking about on Thursday when you were asking the questions about the spill. If we have the response plans in place, which is the case along, you know, small parts of the state, then we know exactly what to do, where the equipment is, what equipment's needed, what to protect, and we have a bigger chance of capturing what gets away or preventing it in the first place. Could you repeat the second part of your question?
How long it takes for the system to recover?
Mr. Representative Messerly, that's a tough one to answer, and sometimes it's fairly quick. If the material moves quickly past, it either recovers or it's a problem for some other part of the river. In other cases, it takes literally years or decades. It just depends on what the contaminant was, how pervasive the contaminant was, and what was happening at the time. At the one that's here, the air sparging one, there was smoke and adult salmon or adult fish moving different ways in this river, but at the same time. If you take out, you know, a significant number of those fish, then it takes a long time to recover. So it depends what you hit them with, when you hit them, and how, you know, how much. So.
Sure, can I follow? As referring to one married to the fuel spill, such as diesel or gas from Russia and
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, it's still, even with those, it depends. I mean, some of those, like the tar balls in Coos Bay, the tar balls themselves can keep coming up for months, sometimes years, and so there will be some contamination that continues to happen. If it's light fuel and it moves too quickly, then you have your immediate impact and then don't have any impact anymore. But there are some species that recover quickly. In XMLD, some of the species, in a couple cases, they're at least as good as they are, as big in numbers as they were before the wreck, and others haven't recovered even after a decade. So even with petroleum, it really depends on the circumstances.
Sure. If I can make just a brief statement.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to get at is that I wonder sometimes if we don't, you know, this is obviously very costly for someone to do everything, so whether it's a railroad company or insurance company or who. Not to minimize the potential impact there, but if we don't overreact sometimes, and in some cases, my guess is that we probably recover very little, if any, and that the system, you might have a chunk of time there where you're losing some of the species and that type of thing, but if the system really recovers quite rapidly, I wonder if at some point, you know, if we run more and more cost into what we're trying to accomplish, if we need to prioritize some of these things and say, well, here's where we can really make an impact, and we really need to be very serious about these. In other cases, if it's in an area with tidal effects or there's a lot of movement of water or whatever, I'd do the best we can, but let's not get overly ambitious about this because it's really a losing battle. It's very costly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, you're right. I mean, there is a prioritization that needs to happen. I think I mentioned earlier, during the Clarissa spill, during that time period, there were 67 other spills across the state. Some of those, we make that exact prioritization call and don't even go. You take the information over the phone. It seems, at least based on the information that you get, that it's not a high environmental priority. If it's into a fish creek or a fish river, then you're more likely to go. But that prioritization does happen. It's not necessarily that you know that it's going to be gone before you get there, but there are lots of highway spills that we don't go to. And there is, a point of diminishing returns. It also makes prevention the smarter way to go because, especially with spills, your percentage captured isn't very good.
I'll remind the panel that we need to conclude by 9:45.
I'll go back.
Go back.
Moving to the next slide, then. The prompt response protects water and the environment. It also avoids the lengthy and costly cleanups that Representative Messerly was just mentioning. This is an example where things didn't work right. There wasn't a prompt response. This one happened a long time ago. It happened in 85, but it's a good example because now we're doing a cleanup. It was three different compartments of solvent in a truck, a tanker truck. There wasn't any substantive action immediately. In 1990, after it had been there for some time, EPA ordered the trucking company to do what it could. It did groundwater monitoring and groundwater treating and pumping and slowed the plume's movement. In 91, the order expired. The company was out of business and treatment stopped. In 94, DEQ started getting calls about problems in groundwater wells adjacent to this one and had to go back in. It's now a full-blown cleanup. This is exactly the kind of thing we're trying to avoid by doing cross-response to fill. The picture on the right, what you see is soil cleanup, groundwater cleanup, all of it underway. This has been a costly cleanup for the state. The one good piece of good news in this one, though it's hard to see in the picture at all, is we are also doing experimental work at this site with the University of Washington using poplars, and we're irrigating the poplars with contaminated water, with highly contaminated water, to see if we can clean it up that way and cut our costs. So that's one that we would like to use more in the future.
Just that approach has been a little controversial in that the neighbors have commented, and I know I've had some mail, I imagine other representatives and senators have had a little bit of mail about the idea that it mitigates spills with biological controls. And I guess there are some questions about odors and some other things, but I guess it remains to be seen whether this particular site demonstrates the efficacy of the use of cottonwoods as a removal and mitigation mechanism. Now, do the cottonwoods actually break down the hydrocarbons, or do they? How does that mechanism work for you now? Should it just perspire, or is it the transpiration or respiration or transmogrification? I mean, how does this work?
Mr. Chair, I think it's the last one. The fact is, we don't know. They have done everything conceivable with these trees to try to figure out exactly what happens to the stuff, if you will, whether it does get transpired or whether they actually just use it up or break it down enough that it goes into, it actually gets used. They can't find it in leaves. They can't find it in what vaporizes. They haven't found it, but they do know that it's decreasing the amount of solvent, so they're still trying to figure that out. So it's the last one.
And on that note, so it's a promising technology, and we can use the bulk. We'll be back tomorrow with the same agency, picking up where we left off here. And, any other activities? Any sort of many questions?
I think it's public testimony tomorrow, isn't it?
It is for public testimony tomorrow. We'll be back with the agency budget tomorrow for public testimony and other considerations. So that, we're in adjournment.